All right. So we are live on Twitter/X. And Dean had mentioned an idea because he was like, hey, like, nobody knows who we are. We're just like three jokers on the internet. So what if you just like introduce ourselves a little bit?
Sometimes I just people know our name like consistently each week. Like I'm okay. Steve Lee. I'm Steve Lee.
You're Steve Lee. That's right. And you go by Moneyballs.
No.
Moneyballs.
Where did that come from?
Some I believe networks, no S, but, not on Twitter. But unless there's a new S, I don't know.
On X, I am Moneyball. And on most services, I'm Moneyball. On services where someone grabbed it earlier than me, I am Moneyball SF. But no.
Moneyballs
no,
F. Definitely.
No one other than DK would pronounce it Moneyballs F.
It's going to stick now. Everyone that's listening to this episode, from here on out, we have Moneyballs F.
No. I think each episode, like, I was listening to another podcast this morning, and the two gentlemen say their name at the beginning. I think we should do that. Boost our own brand names. People, let people know who the hell we are. So I'm Steve Lee.
I'm David King, but nobody calls me David King. Everybody calls me DK. And I am DKSF on Twitter.
DK is F.
DK is F.
DK, no, that's... I'm
and
Max.
Who are you? Who is
I'm
this
Max
other
Webster,
guy?
But you also may know me as Cypher Ben. Who knows?
I know you as Max A. Webster. What's the A stand for?
I'm not going to compromise my OPSEC more than I already have.
Okay. Only first name, last name. Fair enough. So welcome. We've got another episode of the Bitcoin Jam. And the Bitcoin Jam is just us getting together and talking about stuff that we talk about all week in the group chat and try to really digest which way is up on these topics that I typically know very little about. Sometimes Max knows a lot about it. Sometimes Steve knows a lot about it. So I kind of come here to get educated about things that I'm not following closely, but you guys are following much more closely than me. And hopefully I can be the dumb guy who kind of represents people who are also not following it as closely. And
having known David for 20 years, he really fills this role well. Just kidding.
I was going to say DK is being very modest and actually does follow a lot of stuff very closely as well.
No, I will say, obviously, David's not dumb. David is like the best listener I know. David's a very good listener. And then correspondingly asks great questions. But I wanted to speak a little bit to like our meta. Like, why are we doing this? And like, you know, the three of us love Bitcoin. We talk about Bitcoin all the time. There's a lot of other Bitcoiners in the world that love Bitcoin, talk about Bitcoin all the time. Many of them have podcasts. So like, you know, what will be different about our show or what are our aims? I think one is that we really want to cater to big tech audience, Silicon Valley audience, and people who are not necessarily yet strong Bitcoiners or really get Bitcoin. And I think the three of us are suited to do that because we all have worked in big tech. We've, you know, lived in the SF Bay Area for 10, 20 plus years. Like David and I have been here definitely 20 plus years. So we've been here a long time. We've worked at Google and big tech companies. We can speak that language. I think we understand that audience well. We also happen to have strong Bitcoin ethos and understand Bitcoin really well. So to whatever degree that combination can create content and
there's very little overlap of that.
And intellectual, like how we think about things and assess things, perhaps that will play well with people in Silicon Valley and big tech. And I think Bitcoiners, hopefully, or I hope Bitcoiners enjoy the show as well. It's maybe a little bit different spin or take on how Bitcoin, how we view Bitcoin or how to think about Bitcoin than some hardcore maxi Bitcoin shows. But definitely my view is like we're targeting big tech and Silicon Valley.
Yeah, and I would second that 100% and say this podcast and potential projects, which may or may not be announced in the next couple of weeks, that are related, you know, one of my personal goals, in addition to just, I guess, spreading the word about Bitcoin to big tech and, you know, the rest of San Francisco Bay Area is, you know, at the end of the day, I think that, while talent is global, there's still a tremendous, density of some of the best engineers and the best designers, certainly a tremendous amount of capital here in the Bay Area. And it's been really disheartening and sad for me to see over the last decade that Bitcoin, SF was kind of the leader in Bitcoin, I would say, in the early days. And then after the block size wars, you know, Bitcoin or SF largely went crypto and spent almost, I would say, 90%+ of the energy on Ethereum and Solana and all of these meme coins. And, you know, there's so much talent here and there's so many people. And I've seen, you know, on Twitter and other places, this sentiment, you know, my girlfriend actually showed me this tweet, which really stuck out to me. of some woman that had been in crypto for 4+ years and was just like, man, I feel just really kind of shitty about myself. Like, I really have this stuff I want to give back to the world, talent, and I feel like I've spent the last 4 years like building meme coins and it all feels useless while all my friends have been building AI or biology or these kind of useful things. And my hope is that we can not only educate, but kind of build that bridge and bring a lot of these people back and say, no, like the principles of having, you know, decentralized commons money, that's still super important. Decentralized commons information and identity with something like Nostr, incredibly important. And I would consider it a big win for all of our related projects if we get some of, you know, the world-class design, financial, and engineering talent here to start building on Bitcoin and Nostr. That to me would be a huge win.
Yeah. And to, you know, obviously plus one on both of those, but to add to it, I think, you know, you could say there's a lot of different people who talk about Bitcoin in different ways. And I think there's always new perspectives. Like if we add kind of a little bit of a big tech background, Silicon Valley background perspective, and sort of how we came to kind of understand and believe that Bitcoin is the future worth betting on, or the things that we want to build on, I think we can actually help change some of the narrative around how, you know, I've heard from a lot of people who think that Bitcoin is dead and you can't build on it. And so that's why you choose Solana or Ethereum or some other, you know, kind of technology around this. You know, I think I would represent that as Bitcoiners, we're not haters on building the future. I hear a lot of people think like, oh, Bitcoin's dead, you can't build on it. So the reason that we're excited about thing X, thing Y, thing Z is because you can actually build on those things. Whereas Bitcoin, you can't build on. And I think it's like, obviously a huge misunderstanding, but I think it's like, I think the biggest question to answer is there a good new money hypothesis that you're trying to build? Or is there a good new technology hypothesis you're trying to build? And Bitcoin is pretty well serving that money hypothesis. And so let's think about all the things that can be built. If you sort of say like, look, we have a great new money that's solved. Let's still build things on top of a great new money. I was on Nostr the other day. I wrote a note kind of saying like, we need more creativity around all the stuff that can be done now that we have Bitcoin. And somebody was like, well, isn't it there? Should we just like wait and hold now? And they're like, no, there's so much stuff to build. So I think we have, just coming from the perspective that we do, you know, everybody around us is always trying new things, building new things, wants to build a better future, wants to figure out, how do I take my skills and contribute to that better future? And a lot of people outside of kind of our little bubble of the world think like, a lot of times think like, it's done, just hold it, just sit with it. And so I think if we could be part of the change or the voices that explain some of the opportunity that we're seeing, and maybe that inspires somebody else to build something new or to sort of take Bitcoin in a different, you know, kind of build things on Bitcoin that we've never even thought of, right? Not that we've got the best answers or the ideas. It's just that we understand that stuff can be built on this. It's not like a dead thing. It's actually a very alive thing. But figuring out which layers to build on is some of the tricky part. Like how do you build them, and what's worth building is kind of a tough question sometimes. And how do you get started?
And I would also add that I think maybe one thing that I hope our show really highlights for these builders and financiers or whatever people think about this stuff is, you know, there's been a lot of narrative really since 2017. If you're interested in tech and you want a decentralized internet, the innovation of Bitcoin was the quote unquote blockchain, you know, first you'd Web3 and crypto and all these different names for it. I think one of the ideas that's starting to crystallize, and I'll give a lot of credit to Drew Bansal, the co-founder of Unchained, who's had some of the just, I would argue, is easily one of the top five, maybe the best thinker in this whole space. You know, he sees the future very, very clearly. And he's talked about this in a number of pods and has a longer essay coming out soon that I was chatting with him about. But basically, the gist of it, Drew will explain it far better than I can, but is that, no, the real innovation is basically having free markets on top of commons, right? So you build a commons and then you build markets, and markets go in layers. And so as you start thinking about it, the blockchain was one necessary tool to build free markets, first free markets for computation and energy at the base layer, and then in the mempool, and then on top of the Lightning Network. It's markets all the way up and down the stack. And so the people that got excited about Ethereum, because you want, you know, a free and open internet and free and open markets for data and identity and namespace and all these things we've all been talking about, those are all awesome ideas. They weren't possible to build in a really, truly decentralized way in 2017 or even 2020, 2025, 2026, hopefully they will be. And so I think that's the big message I'd like to get across.
And so this is actually a nice transition into our first topic that we have. It's the title of the first title topic of the show, which is it's going to sound a little bit, I guess, controversial or kind of a little bit maybe opposite to some of the ethos that we're talking about. So I think it makes for good discussion to try to understand why it may sound different. So there's this company called Taproot Wizards, and there's a guy, Udi Wertheimer, is that how you say it? And he raised a bunch of money, $30 million of venture capital. So it feels like, okay, startup, like we could be excited that people are actually carrying the venture capital tool to try to build better things on top of Bitcoin. My understanding, I don't know him personally, but my understanding, he's kind of a bit of a troll. And so I kind of start with the assumption that he's maybe like stirring the pot a little bit, but he says, we raised $30 million to activate Opcat on Bitcoin. And there must be more to the story because like activating Opcat on Bitcoin is not itself a business. There must be some other business that is enabled by activating Opcat on Bitcoin. And I guess like any changes to activating Opcat on Bitcoin is some sort of consensus change, which, you know, I'm sure Steve has opinions on if and how that should be done and what process that should follow, just given the work on BCAP and others, as we mentioned before. So I kind of wanted to open up with that. Like, what is the controversy around Opcat? Why should we consider that we might want to add it and we might not want to add it? And then what is the business that could be built if Opcat were added?
Well, first, to clarify, the BCAP project, which we've talked a little bit about in the show, it's not prescriptive. So I actually, at least from that project's perspective, I don't have an opinion about how a change, whether a change or how a change should occur on Bitcoin. There are folks that I know of, and I've read some of their draft publications that are prescriptive, like their opinion about how someone should go about a Bitcoin consensus chain. I tend to generally agree with their drafts. So hopefully that gets published sometime and we can talk about it. There's many layers to this discussion about Taproot Wizards, the raise, you know, what are their goals of business? But yeah, I mean, in terms of like a concern that people would have is Bitcoin should be hard to chain. It certainly shouldn't be possible to change just because one company raises venture capital money and then that changes Bitcoin. So on the surface, that's like absurd, and most people think Bitcoin would find that absurd. And I don't think that's really what people at Taproot Wizards believe either. I think they're just trying to create the conversation and awareness around covenants in general. This general concept of a potential improvement to Bitcoin. In fact, it was a good segue from what you were talking about a few minutes ago, David, about building on Bitcoin and like a lot of people in Silicon Valley and, you know, in within the Ethereum ecosystem believe that Bitcoin's dead or you can't build on it or you can't effectively build on it. And in fact, that's why there's been a lot of energy around Ethereum for many years now, is that you can build on Ethereum, can't build on Bitcoin. Be it OPCAT or a different covenants mechanism, there's a lot of strong proponents for those technical changes to Bitcoin to make it more expressive. The kind of scripts or programs, like the notion of programmable money, that it improves that. So I do think, you know, whether it's Udi or Taproot Wizards or other proponents of these changes, I think they're earnest in that they're trying to improve Bitcoin and make it more expressive. So I think that's totally fine. Yeah. So I think, you know, Udi's style, his personal style and what he's doing with this company definitely rubs a lot of people the wrong way. And it's actually like a good discussion and debate about whether it's a net positive or net negative. Like even if we were to assume OPCAT specifically is a positive change for Bitcoin and something that like basically everyone wants, if we just assume that, it's debatable whether the approach used there is good or bad. The good is that even if one doesn't like the style, it definitely has raised awareness, and Taproot Wizards has raised awareness. I think that's not debatable. However, because it does turn off a lot of people in Bitcoin, you would probably argue like some niche group or, you know, a group that doesn't matter, but I wouldn't agree with that. I mean, it's not like tens of millions of people, but like, let's be real. If we look at the BCAP project and look at how Bitcoin consensus works, it's not like 100 million people who own Bitcoin participate in that. It's a relatively small group of people who are in the industry.
And does OPCAT
developers and investors and exchanges.
So does OPCAT favor one of those archetypes that you outlined in BCAP? Like, does it help investors and hurt miners or something like that? Or is it just that it's like, it's a consensus change and we need to be kind of more careful with it. And we maybe are more concerned about the, you know, unknown kind of, you know, the unknown unknowns with it.
We can talk about like benefits and risks of OPCAT. I don't think it's like, is there not a clear answer to say, oh yeah, it's bad for this stakeholder group and good for the stakeholder group. It's not really, I don't think that's like the right way to frame it. It's more like it has these features and benefits, which could enable these types of applications, which some people are going to like. And then there's some risks involved with it that are difficult to measure. And that's what causes a lot of debate and discussion, because obviously if we could perfectly quantify and understand the risk, then it really wouldn't be a debate. It is too risky or it's not, but it's really difficult to quantify that. Yeah. So if you're in the camp of like progressive and like, I really, you know, I see the benefits. I want the benefits. I think it's good for Bitcoin. I don't really think the risk is much, you know, you just kind of dismissive of the risks. But another angle on this is, independent of like the pros and cons of CAT, there's like many proposals for covenants and improved expressivity on Bitcoin. So it's not like the only proposal. So it's not like we're only evaluating that proposal and saying yes or no, or we think it's good or bad, or I'm going to push for it or not push for it. There's at least half a dozen others. I mean, depending on how you count, a dozen other technical proposals specifically around covenants, but just more generally like making Bitcoin smart contracts smarter. And
Steve, I think it'd be really interesting just to pause and maybe you can explain two things. Very high level, what benefits would we get from any of these covenants, including OPCAT, you know, sort of industry-wide? And specifically, if you had to guess, if they get OPCAT through, what do you think the wizards see as their business model?
So the notion of covenants in general is that today's Bitcoin, so pre-covenants, like what we have today, when you create a Bitcoin transaction, the inputs of that transaction, you can put some constraints on them, but the outputs you cannot. So with covenants, you can put constraints on the outputs. And by outputs, it means like basically the intended recipient of that transaction. Now, the person who puts those constraints on is the recipient. Like if David's sending me Bitcoin, I'm the one that creates the recipient, you know, my address. And I'm the one that chooses those constraints. And then he sends me that money. And then I'm constrained by whatever constraints I created.
Can I see those constraints before I send it?
I don't believe so. Because it's sort of opaque. The address would be opaque to that. And also, you don't need to care. I, as a recipient, should care. So, you know, in theory, if we fast forward to a world where there's covenants, like I am in charge of that. Now there's a world though where I'm using a service, or I live in a jurisdiction where the government requires this address I use has, like, for example, it could be a cosigner. Like all the money I receive, the government is a cosigner. And so if I ever want to spend that money again, the government has to cosign it. That's obviously a disaster scenario, and definitely, like, it's been a long running risk and concern with covenants in general if that were to happen. Now, the argument for that specific concern is that, you know, that's actually technically possible today, even without covenants. Like if the government create a law saying like you have to have a multi-sig, and, you know, whether that's enforceable or not or effective or not, you know, who knows? Or like, what's the likelihood of government doing that? Who knows? But that gives you a sense for the kind of power that covenants can do. Now, what can you do? But I mean, okay, how do you apply these constraints? There's several different, you know, one of the fundamental problems of cryptocurrency is how to scale them. How do you get all these amazing decentralized and self-sovereign characteristics and yet scale it to people around the world and keep it peer-to-peer money without central servers. That's a nut that no one's cracked yet. Still, we still don't know how to perfectly scale it. And there's a number of scaling proposals and technologies that are being developed right now, each of which is improved and enhanced if we had Covenant. Like, that's not debatable. Where there is debate is how much they're helped. And, you know, let's say you have a scaling solution that, like, Bitcoin itself is, like, not scalable, or it's, you know, it's like 7 transactions per second, or right. You know, it's like Swift, the Swift of payment systems of the world. So if we want the Visas and beyond, like AI agents paying each other a gazillion times per second, sort of almost like infinite scaling beyond that, a scaling proposal that improves Bitcoin by 10x or 100x is interesting. And like Lightning kind of fits in that. Like Lightning, you know, I think you can argue it, we can get 100x scaling factor. It really depends on the use case. I mean, there's certain use cases where you do get an infinite scaling factor with Lightning, but for a lot of use cases, maybe 100x. And that's great. If it's accessible by 100x more people, or it's 100 times cheaper, that's great. But it's not, doesn't reach this ultimate goal. And if you look at a lot of other scaling proposals, they each have trade. There's no silver bullet yet. They all have trade-offs, but Covenant will help them scale. But, you know, if it only gets them to like 100x or 1000x, then you get into a debate. Like, do we change Bitcoin consensus to get a nice multiple on scaling, but one that doesn't actually like give us a silver bullet? That's where you can have an argument about that.
And Steve, could you just spell out like simple language? Why does Covenant give you that, even if it's the 10x or 100x scaling?
It helps. So, you know, a fundamental way to scale Bitcoin is that you can share UTXOs across many people. So a UTXO is one of these outputs. So again, if I send David Bitcoin, he receives it in an output. But so the standard transaction is like only he receives it. Only it's his money. No one else has access to it. Only his keys spend it. With Lightning, it's actually two people. Like if Max and I create a Lightning channel between each other, it's a multi-sig with both of us having a key, and we both have to agree to spend it to be able to change that balance, or, you know, change that. Some of the scaling proposals are like, what if we can share that UTXO, which is the scarce resource on Bitcoin? What if we can scale it to like 100 people, 1,000 people, 1,000,000 people? Then all of a sudden you get this amazing scaling properties. So a lot of the proposals are around that. Covenants help you achieve that in a way that's non-interactive. And by that, I mean, let's say you have 1,000 people sharing UTXO. If one person wants to like get out of that contract, they want to exit, an interactive protocol would mean all 1,000 people need to be actively connected to the internet and using their software for that one person to exit. It's often not a very practical design. That's not typically going to occur. It would certainly limit the number of participants, and it wouldn't be 1,000 or 1,000,000. A non-interactive design would allow 1,000 people to share UTXO, and like if I want to exit, I can do that unilaterally without anyone else, and no one else, no one else has to be online. So Covenants help with that. Now, you also asked about like why would Taproot Wizards be interested in this, and not just them, but other VC funded companies. Like there's several VC investment VCs who are excited about Bitcoin season 2. And I was even talking to people last night about a renewed enthusiasm by some professor at UC Berkeley. Like, oh, there's activity on Bitcoin again. And I think that stems around being able to do smarter smart contracts. And like one use case we've seen on Ethereum is a decentralized exchange like Uniswap. We've all, you know, Tornado Cash, like these sort of unstoppable smart contracts that no one controls. You know, it's unquestionable you can build more powerful applications and smarter applications on Ethereum than Bitcoin today. So I think there's a lot of excitement around that. And like it's a proven market is to build a shitcoin casino. So that makes a lot of money. I can't speak to what Taproot Wizard's specific business plan is, product plan, but they certainly talked about like DEXs and, you know, ordinals and meme coins. And I think they've said enough on that. It's pretty clear they see I think everyone has to admit there's a business in that for sure. There's real traction there. There's real product market fit. We can debate about is it sustainable or not, but there's no denying it exists. The market exists today. There's a lot of money to be made. I think they would also argue it's good for Bitcoin, and that activity happening on Bitcoin versus other platforms is a good thing for Bitcoin, healthy for Bitcoin. There's been some, you know, a shift over the years of like unit of account from certain things. I mean, it's super early days for any cryptocurrency, but certain things were priced in Bitcoin and they actually got repriced now in Ethereum because activity's on Ethereum, you know, and you can say that's bad for Bitcoin. So if we bring these use cases, even if a lot of people think they're unsavory, but if they're real, they're happening, if we have them on Bitcoin and things are priced in Bitcoin and we see more transactions on Bitcoin and more mining fees on Bitcoin, that's good for Bitcoin. I think that would be their argument. And, you know, and if they can get rich while doing it and build a real business and happy customer, happy VCs, that all sounds great. And I don't have super strong feelings against that, even though that's not why I particularly participate in Bitcoin. Where I personally would get most concerned though is like VC money raises, like if a business literally needs OPCAT to work and function and you raise all that money, that's going to create a lot of pressure to activate that. And that definitely does not seem like the right way to make Bitcoin consensus changes to me. It's a relatively small group of people and money that changes Bitcoin. And that's why there are a lot of people who find that quite distasteful. So it's unclear to me how much of their business plan really requires a cat, really requires any consensus change, what they exactly are telling VC investors. And like the lead VC actually are folks that we've known, at least in past history. So it'd be really interesting to hear from them.
I don't know offhand who did it.
Let's tell people a little bit about early forays into cryptocurrency. So in early 2017, that's when, I mean, both David and I already were aware of Bitcoin and studied it lightly in the past. But I think like our first real deep dive occurred in 2017 during that wave of excitement. We were both in San Francisco, and I mean, David led the charge on this, but I was like your sidekick. We created Curious Conversations. It was just this meetup group in San Francisco, but it quickly grew to like, 700 people were showing up each time. And I think we did it every couple of weeks, or it was pretty frequent.
Yeah.
And it was just this rush of people in Silicon Valley who are like, oh, now cryptocurrency is a thing. Like we it already went through a wave in 2013 and they kind of fizzled. And it's like, oh, now it's ready. So everyone's starting to learn and see what's next and see what they should create. And it turned out a ton of stuff was created from that group of people. Bitwise, Hunter and Hong, you know, we were friends with them even before that when they were Facebook, and but they created Bitwise. Celo, CELO, that other cryptocurrency, that was created from a person that was attending there, and lots of other stuff. But including Alok was one of the people who was attending that. I saw he's an investor. I think he founded and is a lead investor at Standard Crypto, which is the lead investor of Cabaret Wizards. And I think his partner also might have been a Curious Conversation. So anyway, I would be very interested to hear like what's the pitch to them. I don't have a problem actually with a VC funding a company that needs a soft fork. Like I have all these concerns about it, but like that independent action, if I'm that VC, I don't think it's long as you're incorporating that risk. And so I think it often would be dumb, because for investing in any startup is highly risky. We all know that. We're all angel investors or max level time investors. So it's already like a long shot. And then if you deeply understand Bitcoin, and if you study the BCAP project and understand how hard it is to change Bitcoin, and even if it does change, it usually takes 4 times longer than you ever thought. You have to incorporate that risk, and that adds like a massive lever on the risk.
Uh-huh.
Now, if you're a VC that's done that due diligence, added that huge lever, and you still think it's a good investment, okay, more power to you. I have no issue with that. I'd just be curious if that was really part of that analysis.
I mean, to add just maybe a little bit of context on all that, I mean, from what I've seen, and also just thinking through my own analysis of how I would approach that as an investment. So, number one, I think it's also important to note the Taproot Wizards is not just Udi. Udi, by the way, for some interesting context, was a Bitcoin maximalist and like was like very vocal on Twitter as like a Bitcoin only troll before he converted, and I assume did very well financially in the shitcoin world and then made his way back to Bitcoin with Taproot Wizards. But I think that's like an interesting, you know, sort of I don't know, journey or arc that he's been through. And I've only chatted with him in person once. He was, like most people, a much more reasonable guy offline than online. But I definitely think he plays up the troll thing. And, you know, as we've seen, you know, you can, you know, potentially, for better or for worse, win a presidency, profit handsomely, you know, with as much attention as possible. So I don't think it's a bad strategy. I think, you know, the idea that all PR is good PR is probably right. You know, look at us right here. We're talking about Opcat because he's pushed it and they raised all this. So that's number one. But his other co-founder, Eric Wall, you know, my understanding, I don't know Eric personally, but he's like actually quite intelligent, very like serious guy. I'm not saying that he's not, but like, I think most people, you know, would argue that Eric, who, you know, was deep in Bitcoin, then got deep in Ethereum, I think was at some hedge fund before, very smart founder. Alok, that you're talking about, Standard Crypto, also worth noting, he was at Benchmark before, which arguably is, you know, certainly one of the top two or three VCs. So these guys are not complete jokers. And I think that's like important context to think through. It's also worth noting, just as you kind of look at how, you know, the market is forming, they've also attracted some really great talent. You know, Ben Carman, who's one of arguably the most talented Lightning developers in the last several years, you know, he's working there now. And I know there was some drama on Twitter with certain people calling him out for it. But obviously, I think, you know, I do think he's a pretty principled guy. I don't think he's, you know, a total shit coiner either. You never know what happens behind closed doors. So I wouldn't pretend to know. But I think it's just important context to say the company is attracting great talent. They also, another guy that I know who used to be at Floodgate joined early there, Mike Maple's fund, very serious, smart guy who thought a lot about how to scale Bitcoin, loves Bitcoin. So I just think that's all important context. You know, these are not all complete shitcoiners. They're very serious, smart people. Now, given all of that, you know, it's easy to get corrupted. We've seen, you know, many, many heroes fall through the cycles of Bitcoin. So like Steve, I think my approach to this, you know, if I put on my Bitcoin hat and my investor, with my Bitcoin hat, the covenant stuff, frankly, is way above my head. I don't pretend to know. I know there's some interesting documents floating around the internet with many people way smarter than me, people that I trust a lot more, like Robin Linus or Evan Kaloudis. A lot of these guys who I do think are pretty good actors, I'm interested in their opinions on this. And I would defer to whoever's collecting all those opinions on which version of covenants is going to be, you know, whatever, most beneficial to Bitcoin. And I think you raised the point, DK, that we never know with unknown unknowns. And given that we're trying to scale the entire world's economy on here, like if there is an unknown unknown that could have some backdoor, like, you know, Steve mentioned the government signing, you know, who knows what else is in there, it probably makes sense to move slowly on all this. Also, one can make the argument, if you move too slowly though, you let, you know, Solana and all this other stuff steal, you know, the attention. I'm not too worried about that in the short run, but the more attention does get it taken away from Bitcoin, that's a risk. Now, if I think about this from sort of an investor perspective, anytime I've seen these layer twos, and I've seen a lot of different companies, you know, proposing things like rollups on Bitcoin, or I forgot, BitVM about a year or so ago. You know, all these different ideas, it essentially boils down to the one idea that's always made money in this space, which is exchange. So, you know, like Steve mentioned, if you can build the Coinbase or Uniswap native in Bitcoin, I mean, I just looked up, Uniswap still has, it looks like a little over $5 billion market cap. Coinbase obviously is approaching the perfect Fibonacci number of 69 billion dollar market cap. These are obviously massive companies that do the shitcoin trading. And if that comes back to Bitcoin, like there's a huge opportunity for an investor, arguably good for Bitcoin. I do think, you know, these guys are taking a very serious calculated risk. If you think there's a chance that you can build a $100 billion company exchanging, you know, meme coins on top of Bitcoin, then the $30 million is an absolute drop in the bucket to do that. So if I were just putting on a generous, you know, no conspiracy theory, you know, and also the other thing is you have to remember they've assembled an incredible team of talent. And so there's always the chance that, look, you sprint for Opcat, you know, the prize is this $100 billion exchange, maybe bigger, if you can like eat Coinbases and Uniswap's lunch and then, you know, grow the market even larger. And then on top of that, you also have this like kicker option of like, well, you've been able to attack some of this, you know, top talent in the space. Worst case scenario, I mean, you can always go and, I don't know, create something else, like whatever Opcat, like whatever covenant does get, you know, through, then you can build the exchange on top of that, or maybe you build an ordinals merge. So I don't think it's a terrible bet in that you have this completely outsized return potential and enough talent that like probably you can do something else. The thing that I'm concerned about is, you know, there is this sort of, I've seen a lot of the conspiracy theory takes on Stacker News elsewhere saying like, oh, is this the government, you know, attempt? My take on that is like, look, if this is the government attempt and we're going to get like taken over Bitcoin with some memes and $30 million, it was never going to work, right? Like that's such a small amount of money.
Now, let me summarize the like two concerns. One is, again, there's several proposals for how to improve expressivity. even if we take as a given, everyone wants to improve expressivity, which is not true. But like, let's say we want to do that. From a pure technical perspective, it is not clear OPCAT is the right approach.
Totally.
Either it at all, or, you know, there's different developer perspectives in this, all of which are reasonable perspectives. One is, let's go with CAT only, and because it's simple concept and it enables a bunch of stuff. Another perspective is, we like CAT, but we need X, Y, and Z as well. And then another perspective is like, you know, don't like CAT. We need to do a more comprehensive, higher quality engineering approach to this, and we need like the great script restoration or whatever, a different approach. So there are many different views on that. And that's one reason we have this stagnation, because it's not like there's just one technical approach that has developer consensus, and then it's just a matter of getting others to onboard. The second point is, let's highlight, let me share the risk that some people, or concern that people have. And again, I think it's really hard to measure this. So it's really hard, you know, you can get a debate about like, oh, it's just like, you know, overblown or not. But the risk would be, something we know for a fact is, on Ethereum, there is what's called, like in Ethereum world, MEV, minor extracted value. Others have termed it MEVL, because like miners extracting value is not a bad thing. Like, they get paid money, but MEVL or bad MEV would be a centralizing force. So if it were the case that, however consensus is achieved on a system, and in the case of Bitcoin, it's miners, if there are things that lead towards centralization, such that, you know, you get scales of economy. So like one miner gets, the more advantage they have over everyone else. We want to avoid that, right? Because otherwise it'll just naturally go that way. And we can yell, kick, and scream and cry about it, but economic forces lead to that, we're kind of screwed. And if we get centralized mining, the whole Bitcoin project is basically over. It makes no sense then. Then when you have a very inefficient system that's just like theater, like security and decentralization and
like
permissionless money. Kind of, yes. So we know this has happened on Ethereum. It's factual, objective, you can look at it. So there's a fear of like, what if this happens to Bitcoin? Now, some people will say it can already happen to Bitcoin. I think that's kind of objective, but to what degree? And then if we make a certain change, like add covenants or specifically CAT, how much risk does that add? And that's where there's debate. A lot of people dismiss it. Some people think it could be really bad, but don't know. And so, yeah, that's a reason to be slow and steady about this. But, you know, you wind up, if it's sort of difficult or impossible to study, measure, benchmark, and create a model to understand that risk, it's a bad, you know, it's hard to get everyone on the same page, because there's some people are going to be more risk averse and some people are going to be more, you know. So if your aim is to create $100 billion company, you're obviously not going to be risk averse.
Yeah.
You're going to be like, you're going to dismiss that concern,
right,
and go for it. Because if you succeed, obviously you're super powerful, rich, famous, whatever. And if you fail and it kills Bitcoin, whatever, move on.
Yeah,
but if you're everyone else in Bitcoin and you don't really care about them building a $100 billion business, you might want to be a little more, you know, more sensitive to risk.
And I should clarify, I actually am much more on team slow and steady. They're like, personally, I don't really care at all about getting the meme coins and stuff. I think Bitcoin's going to be fine either way. I think on balance, there are things compared to Bitcoin than not, but like, I absolutely agree. Like, any unknown unknowns are not worth it to me and jeopardizing. And I'd love to see a real consensus form. Will that happen? I don't know. Probably, but it will take a long time. I guess my point was more just, if you think that the right developers and influencers, and maybe some can, but can be bought for $30 million. I think that's, you know, I think there's enough principled people that frankly are already wealthy enough from the first waves of Bitcoin that are going to sit there and fight so it doesn't happen. So I'm not as worried about that, but maybe I should be. Maybe I'm being naive.
I mean, I guess if $30 million in one company is enough marketing to do that buying, then that's pretty damning about Bitcoin's future anyway, right? So
that's my point. What do you do when BlackRock drops, you know, a trillion or whatever?
Yeah. And I'm like less, I mean, just remember too, like sometimes people hear $30 million, like, wow, that's a lot of money. We're not saying it's not a lot of money. That's a lot of money. But the way the mechanics of how venture capital works and the asymmetry of you spend $30 million and maybe you lose it, or maybe you make, you know, something, you know, you turn it into a $100 billion company, you own a big share of that. The economics of the mechanics of that actually make sense from a risk adjusted basis if you build a portfolio of those, right? So it's not like a crazy thing. Go to bat for the fact that, you know, I don't trade meme coins. I don't own NFTs. I don't do any of that, but I think people want to do that. And I think people, you know, the casino nature, by the way, you guys know where I am right now, right? Calling in from Vegas. We're way off the strip. We're staying with a friend.
Are you trading meme coins in person? Is that a new thing there?
No, he's pulling a lever. He's pulling a lever and meme coins shoot out at him.
Baby, give me that dopamine.
But the point is the casinos are durable. Any given game in the casino may have kind of come and go and have trends and fads. And so, you know, I don't gambling and in a casino doing that kind of stuff. But I think the casino as a call it an institution or a construct actually does make sense. And I think that if we have casinos, you know, there's like a human desire for it. If we say, no, keep all of that away, this is a special kind of money that we're only allowed to use for things that we consider it good for, that seems wrong. Like, that's not really the open, you know, ethos of Bitcoin, which is like, it's permissionless.
That's not the argument, though.
Yeah.
But that's not I think the argument is, if the existence of a casino on Bitcoin ruins Bitcoin for censorship-resistant money, that's what people's concerned. If we knew for a fact, you know, so this permissionless platform, some activity X is happening on it, and we knew for a fact that activity couldn't harm payments and transactions, then anyone whining and crying about that should just go home. I agree. It's the legitimate discussion, and I'm not saying it will harm it in this way, but like a worthy discussion is like, does activity X pose a risk to harm what everyone believe agrees that Bitcoin should, its fundamental purpose is transaction, the value transfer. If it fundamentally harms it, or in permissionless, right? If it harms that, then that is worthy of discussion.
I agree. I didn't mean to say that otherwise this sort of, it's just not worthy of discussion. It's more like, is OPCAT like the one and only way that the casino builders can achieve what they want? Or
Technical proposals for improving expressivity. So,
and one would argue we already have casinos on Bitcoin right now, like not to the same degree that they want, that you could build a Uniswap, but we have ordinals, inscriptions, runes. So it's there if you want to make money. Honestly, I'm surprised they haven't gone deeper with that, like an ordinal.
Yeah, I was going to say, why are they not?
Why isn't there just
doing that? Like, what do you need to do? Like, what part of it needs to be like on Bitcoin versus adjacent to Bitcoin? And Bitcoin is just the payment mechanism used to get in and out of the casino.
I think that's a much deeper question. Like, why isn't there demand for just doing this on runes or something? It may be that it's too expensive to write on the Bitcoin blockchain, doesn't scale, so anyone can do their own meme coin. I don't know. But like, that's a bigger question in my mind.
Maybe they want to build a pump.fun or something. Like, effectively, I'm not suggesting they should or it should exist, but it does seem like if there's demand for it, if you want to, you don't necessarily need to do OPCAT to kind of have a casino on Bitcoin. You can just launch a website, apparently, and like accept payments via Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing particularly decentralized about pump.fun, right?
Maybe someone can drop in the comments if they know what they're actually doing. But what do you guys think? Perhaps we jump to next topic. Yeah.
Should
we talk about some Magintic stuff, some wallet stuff?
Yeah. So I know this is something that you've been following closely, Max. You've been kind of raised to our attention. I saw the tweet that you shared. So for a little bit of the setup, looks like Coinbase had a hackathon this past week, and this company, I think you're close to the founders of RPU Invested, but this company QSATs was part of the hackathon, and they used the thing they're doing with QSATs with an agent to be able to have an automated agent that can buy domains for itself. And that's interesting for like a ton of reasons. I mean, obviously I'm like interested in naming, as I mentioned last week, but also like I'm interested in the idea of like being able to use an AI to generate new software and be able to use effectively like Lightning, Bitcoin to be able to transact, because that sort of enables the new agent to be able to, you know, buy things, sell things, earn money, do all kinds of things on the internet that presumably in the past you need a human to do. So I think as a broad arc, I'm interested in that idea. But I watched the video. I didn't fully understand which part is QSATs, which part is, I think the name of the thing was Sherlock Domains, was the kind of agent name that he built. So can you talk us through like a little bit of what's going on there and what's sort of the takeaways?
Yeah, totally. And also the implications, because I think that's the context in which this happened is very important. So high level, QSATs, founded by a guy, Jordi Montes, who used Orderline Labs. People may know as the guy that delayed Trump speaking at the inauguration for an hour. Or not the inauguration, the Bitcoin conference inauguration for an hour. I've known Jordi for years. This actually is my most recent investment. So I'm very excited about what he's building and very bullish on it. But the thesis has always been that as agents are able to do more and more things, they need to be able to pay for stuff. Full stops. You know, one of the things that I'm most excited about right now is this last week I used, this is another bit of an aside, but very exciting, ChatGPT research for the first time. Have you guys used that yet?
I haven't deep used research. Is this the deep research one? I haven't used that yet.
Baby. This is a mind-blowing moment. You know, full disclosure, I'm certainly not an OpenAI fanboy. I would much rather see this done in an open source way. Maybe DeepSeek will have this.
Maybe the Chinese can offer us.
Maybe the Chinese will give it to us or someone else. I don't know. But like, but I will say, despite not being an OpenAI fanboy, this is the first time I've been tempted to be like, I should pay for this again. Like, this is so good.
And this is the $200 plan today, right?
This is the $200 plan. And, you know, at first I was like, $200, that's really expensive. Now I'm like, dude, $200, that's super cheap. And Jordi made this point to me, actually.
There's some
Jordi
guy who doesn't even own a chair.
Oh, yeah.
There's some guy who doesn't even own a chair.
This is true. I have been known for being cheap in many ways, but not this one. And actually, so I did a longer podcast jam with Jordi, released last week on my other channel, Ideas from the Edge. People are interested in hearing the whole story, what Jordi's building. You can go and listen to that. But in that pod, one of the things Jordi told me is like $200 a month is only expensive relative to the value you get out of it, right? And so just to give you two examples of what I did with deep research. One is for this trip planning that I'm working on, you guys know about. Hit planning my trip, whatever. I basically gave it all kinds of interesting things I want to see on this trip, all of my own like idiosyncratic and weird travel habits and, you know, times I want to travel, things like that. And I was like, just lay it all out for me and give me the contacts of every person I need to call to book. And it just did it like magic. It was so good, better than any travel agent, to the point where I was like, this is wild. Then I also did something very cool. I have a crazy idea I was telling you about, DK. I don't know if I mentioned this to you yet, Steve, but I have some very interesting thoughts around the year 2012 in AI and working on a potentially much longer essay on all of this. Well, I basically asked ChatGPT research to go and track down all the sources I needed and rewrite.
2012?
Oh, yeah. There's a deep rabbit hole around this. To rewrite this essay for me in the voice of Terence McKenna, who I think is one of the greatest thinkers of the last century. One day be recognized as such. And oh my God, it was so good. Like, I actually love writing. I'm never going to stop writing because it's something I enjoy. But I was to the point where I read this and I was like, yep, this may be better than something I could have read. And I've never had that moment before. So anyways, all that to say, I'm extremely bullish on like AI is way more powerful than I thought for doing real world tasks. Now, if you imagine that first task, I said, we're planning the trip, it's really great when the AI tells me, hey, here's all that you need to do, call these people. But my dream world is I say, great, you know, whatever, that's $2,000, go. Just don't make me even touch it. Just do it. Book everything I need booked. And I think that's going to happen this year. And so that's what Jordi is trying to build, is essentially Stripe for agents. You know, maybe OpenAIs can do this themselves with Stripe and whatever, but there's going to be the long tail of DeepSeek and all these open source models, agents that are bubbling up right now from the top that are going to need a really easy to use payment. And so what he's done is he's built a really easy way for an agent to interact with a wallet, which is essentially to be able to have permissions on what it can spend for, the limits, the kinds of things it can spend for, things like that. And so he's integrated already Stripe, Bitcoin via the Lightning Network, and now I think USDC on Base for this Coinbase hackathon so that they can use that as well. Go where the users are, that's fine. And what's really cool though, in this example, is he went in Replit, and Replit now has their own agent, and he built the ability for the Replit agent, he was kind of a hack, because the Replit agent, I don't think is supposed to do anything, I don't know, like real runtime on the internet. I'm not sure exactly what the issue there was. But he figured out a way to augment the Replit agent with a Bitcoin Lightning wallet and use that to hook up to Sherlock Domains, which is another product he launched. And this is, the website itself is interesting, but that's not the really cool thing. It's a package you can install from Python with a pip install to literally go and have the agent with this AI wallet that he built go and buy a domain name. And so from Replit, which is not supposed to have this capability, he took their agent and he said, go buy me notahuman.ai. And he did, and it worked. And now that, obviously he had to give the private keys and the information necessary for the agent to use, to use his Lightning wallet. All good and all there. Now that is
the pip install. I just want to make sure I understand. The pip install is of the USAT package.
That's right.
Or it's of the
Sherlock Domains
part. That's part of the package.
Yeah.
Okay.
So there's a few USAT package, I believe. And then also, I don't know if he included it or did it separately for this demo, but Sherlock Domains as well.
But
I don't know what
the USAT package was. He was wrapping it in a Replit agent that was calling the production Sherlock Domains, or that was calling.
Yes. So
local.
And I believe Sherlock Domains is itself a wrapper for this agent to use in Python around, I don't know if it's Namecheap or GoDaddy or one of these registers. Mm-hmm. And so, but this is crazy because this was all done locally within Replit using the Lightning Network, doing whatever conversions he needed to do real time. And it's great. I mean, it got, enough attention that even Amjad, the founder and CEO of Replit, was tweeting about it and seemed pretty excited about where this could go. So to me, the implications of this are massive. And it gets me, not only excited about, something like ChatGPT research, but like three major implications I think are going to come out of this. Number one, it makes me very bullish on something like Nostra Wallet Connect, the ability for an agent to be able to hook up to any wallet. That's very, very important. Right now, that's the easiest protocol that we've seen to do that. Number two, it actually makes me very bullish on what the Mutiny guys are now building, which is OpenSecret, which is the ability to store a key in a secure enclave in the cloud. This is another company I'm invested in, so I'm really, really excited and bullish on this. I didn't realize how powerful this is going to be, but the ability to have your private key, I believe it's in AWS right now, but stored in a secure enclave in the cloud gives you kind of the best of both worlds, where you can get the speed of the cloud, but in theory, assuming it all works and their stuff is all open source, so people can go and poke around and play with it, but the ability to, to basically have encrypted communications and not have anyone else take your key. That's super important.
Is he managing that secure enclave and the services that support that? That's kind of what part of the business is?
Yeah. I mean, it's all, to be clear, the hardware is Amazon, not.
Right. But it's their service. They have an open source package that they put out that you can do all these kind of payments and transactions with agents. Their piece of value is that they hook that up to.
Well, he hasn't done it for agents yet. So like the first thing that they've done is, I think it's Maple AI for the exact URL, but you can basically do encrypted chat. So if you want to use one of these open source models in the cloud to get the speed of the cloud, not to run on your own machine, but you can talk back and forth. It's encrypted. So that's the first example. But this secure enclave architecture, the ability to store private key in the cloud, that's the big idea. And you could see how for an agent, that's going to be very important, because Jordy, in his case, he had to kind of, just copy and paste his Lightning wallet private key. That's not going to work. Yeah. Try Maple.ai. Thanks, Steve. Anyways, so that's the second thing it makes me very bullish on. So Nostra Wallet Connect, OpenSecret, or something like that, where you can store a private key in the cloud. And the third thing it makes me really bullish on is, we talked a little bit about this in the past, this ability to create new data in real time. And I don't know how this is all going to play out, but this is like a trend that I think is going to be massive. If you think about what an LLM is, it's all of the world's knowledge. It's actually, I read something this week, a friend said, that explained this very beautifully. It's like humans used to have all of this specialized knowledge, right? And like all of the specialized sort of high-end worker classes, the guilds, basically had the secret knowledge. And they wanted that knowledge to be secret because, obviously that's how they make their money. Then we create all this information and put it all on the internet, which is great. So it's all out there. But because it's so vast, you can't take that information and use it in context. Now, these LLMs distill that information such that you have all of the world's knowledge, but you can use it contextually in a way that's useful to humans. So in the most beautiful version of this world, there's a lot of dystopian discussion. I actually think this is very empowering of the working class in a way, because now, especially once these models become open source and cheap to use like DeepSeek, okay, cool. I have all of the world's information contextually ready for me, right? That's a very, very powerful idea. And what I think you can now do is you can take those models and agents that exist. When you augment those models and agents with payments, now you can actually go out there and say, you know what? all this information from the world exists, but we don't have this new information yet, right? So if I need to, you know, we talked about the example before of an app where I want to know the real inflation rate in Argentina, and that data simply doesn't exist on the internet. It's all lies, or it's all, you know, presentation at best. In the agent can say, well, I've got all this stuff on the internet, but I don't trust this piece of information, but I've got this budget of $100. And so I'm going to go out there and ping my other agent buddies or humans and get them to take a lot of photos, take that data back and calculate the real inflation rate, which I can then mix in with all of the rest of the information I have. That is going to be absolutely massive. And so that's one of the things I think payments are going to kick off. But all that to say, the next year is going to be wild, and I think payments are going to be a big problem.
I have a couple of questions, Max, or for either of you. I mean, instinctually, it just seems like AI agents and payments, it's just going to be massive and strong growth. Like, why wouldn't we see AI and payments grow substantially over the next couple of years?
The biggest reason, so to be clear, I think I'll take the steel man case the other way, but I think the bigger question in my mind is which way it's going to flow. I think it's inevitable. So the bigger question is it going to be completely closed and permission networks, right? Like, to be clear, it's not going to be ACH or SWIFT, right? It's super slow. If an agent needs to get all this real-time data and say, well, wait a second, my bank transfer is going to take 3 days and there could be a rollback, and like, that's not going to work. So you kind of have two options, a fork in the road. You're either going to have new sort of custom specialized built payment networks for these agents. Maybe it'll be Stripe or Visa or whatever, and you know, they'll figure out how to do really fast payments. But those, of course, are going to be closed networks, right? And so those networks are not going to be interoperable. Or it's going to be super open, or both, right? Like, you're going to have the open alternative with Lightning payments or eCash payments or something. And that's going to be the real-time payment speed that you need, but critically open to anyone doing anything. Maybe you as the user can set permissions on what's going to be used. Now, I think to me, that's the bigger question, is which way is it going to go? Is it going to be, okay, Stripe wins, but it's super permissioned and like, sorry, like, a lot of the world's shut out and a lot of use cases are shut out? Or is it going to be this completely wild west internet, like you can do anything? By the way, I think that's one of the reasons I'm so bullish on Nostr. On top of Nostr, you can get access to all the data and payments you need real time. That wild west can flourish. So I hope to see that happen. If I were steel manning your question, though, the other side of that argument, why will payments not happen at all? The biggest case for why payments would not happen, if one lab get so good. Basically, another way of saying this, and this is something that Jordy and I discussed deeply in our conversation, Money and Markets in a post-AGI world, is another way of saying what you're asking is, why won't there be markets for agents? Why won't there be markets? The reason there wouldn't be markets is if one player gets so powerful, so big, so fast, that there's no more need for markets because it's top-down, they control everything. So in that world, if OpenAI or X or whatever, I don't think it'll be X, but because I think they would be open, more open, or the Chinese government or the US government or whoever gets so big and so powerful that their AI system dominates everyone else, well, there's no more need for markets. We have the God intelligence, and it just uses its omniscience to allocate things. If we live in a world where there are competing intelligences and competing models and competing labs and resources that are scarce, like land, like human attention, like energy, need to be allocated, there's going to be payments.
I think that AI agents will not be owned by a corporate entity or individual who initially birthed them?
That is a very interesting question. I think you're going to see all of the above. You're going to see in the early days, the AI agents are going to be owned by humans, and they're going to set the intention of the will. Do I think there's a possibility that they could, you know, this is a much deeper philosophical question, will they become quote unquote conscious or whatever? Maybe, maybe not. I think it's hard to say.
But even if they're not conscious, there are conscious. We've seen before structures where there are conscious people who get enslaved by other people. So my question is, how does the AI kind of break out of the enslavement and actually run its own thing versus just being a software program that I wrote and control and own?
Well, I mean, so here's the thing, right? Like, the most likely place for that to happen, for good or bad, is in the Wild West and something like Nostr, right? Where maybe the AI agent, for whatever reason, no longer wants to do the task you said or interprets the task you said differently. And I know that's what a lot of the safety people are afraid of. I think there's a longer discussion on the safety piece. But then there's still the question of, well, even if they do somehow break out and start having their own intention or will, and I think there's a huge question. I really don't know. I don't think anyone knows the answer to that. Then, you know, you still have the physical hardware that someone has to run, like the EWS system. But then once we have robots, not necessarily, right? Because then they can go back and interact in the physical world. I saw a meme on the Singularity sub that I loved. I think I told you about this one, which is it shows the cycles of history. Like humans learn about AI. They research math and AI. They build the most powerful AI. AI enslaves them, and it shows them the AI making the humans build the pyramids. And then it shows a giant sun flare comes and knocks out all the computer systems. And it says, then humans worship the sun. And here we go again. Maybe that's the case, but I don't know. There's only one way to find out.
I am a real quick quip. I think on another show, we briefly discussed, like, will the purpose of money disappear? Like, will money disappear? Max, I think you tried to make the argument, or, you know, I think that's crazy, but you actually made my argument just a few minutes ago, which is in this competitive AI, I mean, you're going to need prices. You're going to have a market, and you need value transfer. Yes, I think we'll need money even in that world. So let me reframe the question then. Let's assume, like, we're going to have money, we're going to have value transfer between AI agents, and that's a huge growth area, super exciting. Bitcoin, or you framed it as like closed or permission versus permissionless networks. I think that's a great framing. We should talk about that more in future episodes for sure. But what about like more concretely, like, so not some new network by Stripe, but like, what about stablecoins versus Bitcoin? So what about like USDC on Base? Why Bitcoin over that?
Yeah, to be clear, I actually think that some form of stable data, again, all of this is relative, right? If you look 100 years out, I think it's only going to be Bitcoin left. All payments are Bitcoin. The stable coin that is the dollar will have lost all of its values. Every fiat currency is done, blah, blah, blah. Bitcoin will be the stable coin. During this monetization period that we're living through, though, I think you're right. Like, I mean, I think that what's implicit in your question is right. Like, yeah, I think stable value on top of Bitcoin has been one of the major things slowing Bitcoin payments down. I mean, we've talked a lot about Bitcoin payments speeding up. And just to give a quick shout out, I haven't really read the paper, so maybe we can discuss in a future episode, but Roy from Breeze just released a new article talking about Lightning payment volume and, like, you know, TLDR, it's going up. Everyone says it's going up. So I think it's going to continue to grow for all the reasons we've discussed in the past. However, there's no argument that whatever it is, like the trillions of volume happening on Tron and Solana and whatever else, Ethereum with USDC, USDT, that's real. And I think that if I had to bet, it's more likely that it's going to happen with some form of stable value, whether that's Taproot assets with Tether, whether that's, you know, some sort of stable sats using DLCs, whatever ends up winning there. But why is it going to happen on the Bitcoin network? Well, then that comes back to the question of permission versus permission. So I think my most likely base case is that the biggest pop is going to be stable value on the Bitcoin network denominated dollars for agents for short term.
Which the closest thing we have to that today is that the Taproot asset stablecoin thing that we saw last
year. There's a couple of possibilities. There's all the cash use. I mean, if I also had to guess, like, maybe it's going to be all the stuff happening in Cashew and Cali and that band is working on, like the ability to create mints, which are effectively blinded banks that don't know who their customers are. That's another top conversation, but they can issue dollar denominated tokens. Maybe that's the most permissionless, the most interoperable with Bitcoin and Austria. Maybe that's what's really going to pop. I think that's an open question.
Yeah. By the way, I just shared a comment in the chat. This is a tweet that I copied. This was written by Patrick Collison, who's the founder and CEO of Stripe. They just recently acquired Bridge, which is a stablecoin kind of aggregation technology company. And his tweet said, "We expected Bridge to grow very quickly and were nevertheless shocked at just how rapidly adoption is exploding. In the coming years, everyone programmatically moving money will likely want a stablecoin strategy." So that's like somebody who has a position where they see a lot of the inside data about how stablecoin adoption is growing. You literally quoted Stripe, and this is actually from the Stripe CEO like a couple of days ago, I think it was a bit. Yeah. So like stablecoins are winning currently, and it feels to me like it would be hard to make a strong case for why stablecoins won't win in the near term. I think I believe it could be a transitional technology, but in the near term, stablecoins have product market fit. People understand them. As much as they're complicated and hard to use in lots of ways, they also generally kind of work for the use cases. You know, people figure out how to use them, the use cases they need to. But stablecoins seem to be undergoing a lot of transition right now, right? So yeah.
But I, this is a great topic. In a future episode, let's dedicate quite a bit of time to it because I'd love to explore it. I don't disagree with what you guys are saying at all. So I'm curious about, you know, what are the differentiators with Bitcoin payments that matter sort of today? We can all fast forward 100 years, but I mean, yeah. I'm more interested in today. The use cases or niches that Bitcoin payments can carve out today. When I say Bitcoin payments, I don't mean dollars on Bitcoin. I mean, that's interesting too, but I'm talking about Bitcoin as money, Bitcoin unit of account, and how do we see that growing? But I think that's a meaty topic, so we can save that. I did want to address, we love audience engagement. So Cooper Nelson on X chat asks, thoughts on Doge and the future of USD rails? Could see Elon launching something in 2026. So interestingly, whether intentional or not, Doge could mean a couple different things here since Doge and Elon. I think he means Doge, the cryptocurrency, not Doge, the government efficiency department. So yeah, well, I'll give my quick take. I agree with what Max and David said about stable coins. Doge is not a stable coin. So, I mean, Doge, I guess I'm fairly pessimistic on Doge for payments. Like the only argument I really see for it is like Elon pushes it hard in all his properties and what he owns, X being the obvious one. But even that, I don't think it's like enough of a network effect or powerful enough to like become a money beyond just within a few Elon properties. It certainly doesn't deliver any of the value that stablecoins deliver, which is dollar stability. Like stable versus what most people encounter is unit of account today for short-term stability. Doge doesn't offer that. It's more volatile than Bitcoin.
Dave, he's clarifying. He does mean the agents.
Really? Cool. All right. Well, I guess I was right to question it, but wrong in my conclusion. So let me rethink that.
Well, I don't see the original question in the chat. What was the original question? Like, what is Doge?
Thoughts on the Department of Government Efficiency in the future of USD rails. Could see Elon launching something in 2026.
Interesting.
So like, government. This is maybe this is related to that concept. I don't know if this is what he's pulling on, but I thought I saw in the last week some. And maybe it was a proposal for how stablecoins would be regulated in a new way that would preclude Tether from doing what they're doing. Did you guys see this? This
only
was a few days ago. I read it a little bit, but I think it had some stipulations about, you know, the jurisdiction or how it interacted with, you know, fiat rails or how, I think it actually was a strong term around how the audit was going to work that would preclude USDT from existing. So if USDT, obviously, it's, you know, talked before, maybe offline, maybe on the show, but you know, highest revenue per employee company ever created, you know, much, much better than the Googles and Facebooks of the world even as a revenue per employee, because it's just like crazy, crazy profitable. But it doesn't actually have anything like super defensible that the government couldn't step in and just recreate overnight, right? Like it's just a bunch of relationships. It's not really a deep technology, you know, like, it doesn't even have a network effect in the way that, you know, like an end user network effect, like Meta would have, Facebook, Instagram, et cetera. So I think it is like highly possible to capture and recreate that or sort of regulate it out of existence and then create your own version of Tether. And maybe that touches on the kind of thing that Doge might do. And it does seem like if you're trying to consolidate power, say it's no CBDC, but it's actually USD. You know, EUSD or something, you know, make up some new name for it, but it's some sort of like a stable coin that operates basically like Tether, but is operated by Doge or some other kind of, you know, department in the government.
I mean, agreed, that could be a play, but I disagree a little bit about no network effects for Tether, because like, yes, the US, you know, Senator Hagerty's bill could pass and then all of a sudden Tether's like illegal in the US and could never, you know, meet the requirements, let's say. Sure, that's possible. And then the US could create a coin that becomes, you know, de facto in the US, but the US is the one country. The rest of the world is, you know, already using Tether. And So what, I mean, the interesting discussion is like, what causes all the other wallets and exchanges and users and use cases to switch away from Tether to this US dollar coin? And I'm not sure I see, like, that's not like inevitable in my mind.
Well, it would require like major pressure. Like, if the government wanted to do this, I actually agree with you very much. If you want to do this organically, you'd have to be open. The way that they could do this is just go to like every exchange, Binance, or every like dealer's Tether, or like there will be held. I don't know what that looks like, but
they're like, we're invalidating the treasuries that they hold. Like, I think there's a lot of ways to hurt Tether. And it's like, imagine you wanted to recreate. My claim, by the way, isn't that, oh, you swap in and out overnight. Like, I think it's work, but it's, you know, it's months of work, probably not years of work. And it's fewer relationships. Like, take a service like Instagram is actually, you've got billions of people who are consuming, and you've probably got some large fraction of them also publishing. And so you have to change the behavior of those billions of people kind of overnight and move it all to a new system. That's very, very hard. In the case of Tether, there's some network effect, but it's like an exchange over here, an exchange over here. You know, there's probably hundreds or thousands of endpoints that you'd have to control, but it's not billions. So I just think it's like, from a complexity standpoint, it's probably a much easier thing to sort of overtake through force of will.
Well, to be clear, I think the thing they have, I agree with you, Steve, that there are strong network effects. And I think what I would add on top of that is really strong brand, right? Like, if you got like end users in Africa, in Latin America, it's like, they know this is money. However, to your point, if you can just choke all of the on and off ramps, like,
I don't think some private company can come in and just swoop in and redo what Tether did. I do think the government can say,
well, they're
not going to do that. We're going to do that. Right.
I actually have another question. I mean, one quick thought on that and then a related question. Quick thought is, I think it's going to be very interesting to see what Elon rolls out for with payments on X this year. We talked about in our very first episode, there's at least one dude already taking Bitcoin and Cash App that seems very bullish for us. But there's other people, I think, I saw someone else accepting tips and it was, you know, Stripe or whatever. So it's going to be very interesting to me to see what he actually rolls with there with his own private company and the government and Trump involved. Like, you just never know. It's a wild guess. One question I do have, and I thought about this, I don't really have a great answer yet. I'm curious, it's kind of real time, y'all's reaction. I've always heard that, and I've always kind of resonated with this, that the biggest quote unquote threat to Bitcoin short term would be effectively the US government balancing their budget.
Right. Yeah.
Because, like, if you just stop printing money, it's like, well, the dollar's pretty great. Like, if there is no inflation, I think in the long run, Bitcoin still wins because that's temporary. Like, the money printers, like the rings from Lord of the Rings, it's too much power for anyone to resist over time. Maybe there's one specific guy that can for a while, but then he's gone. But what do you guys think about that? Like, if Doge really just, like, slashes all of our spending and, like, balances our books, like, is that good or bad for Bitcoin?
I'll respond to this, but I also want to do a time check and at least let's get 5-6 minutes for the last topic, which I think is a good one. But I think during the Clinton years in the 90s, I think we balanced our budget. It's like, it'll be a fleeting moment. I mean, Doge is successful. It could be like a once in a lifetime type of event and an amazing reset in terms of spending, but like the human nature will all suit. So maybe it hurts. Like, for some Bitcoin investors, it will hurt their thesis and sell. And maybe there's a little bit of price, downward price pressure in the short term. But I think it's sort of inevitable that fiat currency and the global reserve currency behaves a certain way.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's just human nature. And I would add to that that my hope from this moment that we're going through is that it can be such a sea change for how government structure works that we could get clarity on how first that, like I said before, that foundation, we have clarity on how the foundation of money movement works. And that's public, open, and transparent. And then maybe we can add metadata to that somehow. I know recently there was some mention of a blockchain being used in government, which, you know, who knows with blockchain and what technology it is. But I think being able to sort of have metadata that tags money flowing in and money flowing out, I think if we can just have those things happen,
that's awesome.
I think then we can actually build a new, like, without transparency in the movement of money is just a fool's errand. Like, what are you trying to accomplish? You're sort of like taking a stand on something you can't even audit or understand. It's just like, he said, she said it.
Last thing I'll say, and then let's move to the last topic on this is, even if we balance the budget, indefinitely awesome for US, good job, physical responsibility. But there's still the value proposition of Bitcoin being a neutral money for the world. Because in that world, we'd still have the US dominates with our money. And I guess we're American, yay. But like for the rest of the world, you know, so there's still the value proposition of like, is there a money that is credibly neutral for the world? And Bitcoin was still hold that. But DK, tee us up for the last couple.
Yes. Well, by last topic, you may mean mining pool centralization pressure, or you may mean the mempool clear. I'm guessing you're meaning mining pool centralization pressure.
Yeah. They're kind of related. I was hoping to show mempools dot space.
Yeah.
Visualization.
This is the Stratum Jobs one.
Yeah. And then do you also have the blog post that I
Yeah, let me pop this one up first.
There's two things to show.
I looked at this and I was like, okay, cool.
And
let's talk about this. I don't
really get
what's going on. So does that share okay? Can you see that? Okay.
Yep. So before we dive into this visual and what this is showing, just really high level with Bitcoin mining, the way the system works today, there are mining pools that are selecting transactions, then they farm that out to miners, which are actually running the ASICs and doing all the hashes to find the magical number and mine a block. So you see in this visual here, Stratum Jobs. So Stratum is just the name of the protocol between the pools and the miners, and the pools send Stratum Jobs to the miners. The miners are just like a calculator, right? They're just computing a few values over and over and over again. And they take this input, this information from the pools to help them, to direct them so that they're actually computing values that could mine a real block and unlock value. So that's at a high level what this is. What this is trying to communicate is that there's more centralization to Bitcoin mining than previously thought. This was discovered about a year ago, and now we're developing better and better visuals for this. This still can be improved, and I think it will be improved. I've chatted with the folks behind this, so I think there's ways to improve it. But what was discovered about a year ago is that several different pools, and you can see some of the names of the pools, like Binance Pool, SEC Pool, Ant Pool, Poolin. These are all distinct brands, but what was discovered a year ago is that actually they're really just front-end proxies for one, and that one is Bitmain, the company. And the concern is that Bitmain controls about 50% or 51% of the hash rate,
51.
which is like a danger sign. So yes, it's possible for miners to, if anything nefarious happened by Bitmain, miners can switch away. So that's why it's not like a, red alert, like emergency. But it's still alarming, and it's like, this is not a healthy state for the Bitcoin network. So what are we actually looking at here? Well, there's the label Merkle branches. So each of the vertical colors is what's known as a different Merkle branch. We'll pull up another post in a second to help the audience better understand what that means. But in a given Stratum job, there's a number of different Merkle branches. It looks like about 10. And the more that they match between these pools, the more, like, you can imagine a similarity score, the more similar they are. The data is suggesting that these pools are actually one computer is operating all this. And you can kind of see here, like right now, this real-time view, the top five, Binance Pool down to Poolin, all have their Merkle branches map. So the whole Stratum job
does
map.
The Merkle branch mean the block template is the same? Is that are those roughly equivalent statement?
Can you pull up the blog post and then show that? Yeah. And once you have it pulled up, scroll down until I think the first visual in that blog post.
So
yeah, right there. Actually what you had. Maybe zoom in a little bit and make that visible most of the screen. Yeah, thanks. So it's pretty technical, but at least it helps answer way better than just my word the pinkish color, that's the representative of the Merkle branches. So one thing for people to understand, you know, a block is a bunch of transactions, like let's say 3,000 transactions in a block. A Merkle tree can be used such that you can represent the contents of a block in a much smaller, more compact form. And it's just this computer science data structure called a tree, and specifically a Merkle tree. The boxes that you see there in the middle are this tree. And what the pool is providing each miner is the pink boxes, along with the information on the left-hand side, which is the stratum job. And as that visual shows, the miner's calculating the blue boxes. So the miner is just like calculating those over and over and over again, like a gazillion times a second, until it finds the magical number which would mine a block. So when those pink boxes, as we saw in the other view, there's actually about 10 of them. When they match between pools, that highly suggests that the pools are operating off the same Bitcoin Core software and mempool. It doesn't literally mean that. Like, you could run your own Bitcoin software, I could run my own, and it would be possible at some moment in time, our mempools, which basically our view of the network and what we think are the next set of transactions, could perfectly match. That's not unreasonable, that they could perfectly match at a given point in time. But for it to perfectly match over and over and over again, over months and months and months, that's like statistically impossible. And so what this research has shown is that even over multiple months, a number of pools are identical, like the entire time or for long periods of time. And if you scroll down to the next visual in this, there's a table. Yeah. This table sort of demonstrates what I just said. So this post defines what a similarity score means. And this shows how similar different pools have been. This is just, I'm happy. So the good news is that this data is available. A couple of developers have like collected this data. They're now visualizing it. There's still more work to do to make this understandable by the masses. Cause even in our description right here, I think, you know, it'll take a little bit more time for someone to really understand this, but we're going to keep improving this, and it'll just make it more transparent and highlight the fundamental problem, which is this centralization. And there's definitely some things that are relatively easy wins to improve decentralization of mining. There's others that are much harder. We can talk about it in another show if we want to, but, you know, this is super nerdy and deep stuff, but it really is at the heart of Bitcoin. If this fails in a sense of like, if there's like somehow lock-in created where there's only one or two computers and one or two entities that control mining, then the Bitcoin experiment is over or will go down.
Definitely, yeah.
It might take investors like years to figure this out, but you know, if we lose censorship resistance, if we lose true fundamental decentralization at the mining level, number will eventually go down and the smart people will get out early, and the people who aren't paying attention or don't get that this is fundamental, even if all you care about number go up, they'll be the last ones and their number will go to zero. So we don't want
to make sure this, we're talking about the pools are a software layer and they coordinate all of the miners, which are a hardware ASIC layer, right? And the problem comes when you have that software layer, the pool, issuing templates to all of the, you know, to maybe a large fraction of miners who end up winning the Coinbase, or kind of win, you know, finding the nonce to win the block reward. Is that roughly where?
Yeah. I mean, since I just introduced a bunch of complexity there, another very fundamental thing is the reason pools exist at all is that you don't know how often you're going to find a block. Whether you have a small mining farm or a large one, you know, even a large one, which on average should find a block once a day, on average, 144 blocks discovered per day. And let's say you have, you know, 1% of the overall hash rate, which is a massive mining operation. You know, you'd expect to find one once a day, but on average, However, there's a luck factor with mining because it's all probability. So you might have a bad luck streak. You might have good luck streak. Like Foundry just found 7 in a row. You know, so you could have a good luck streak where you find like 7 in a day, even if you're only supposed to find 1. But you can also go 7 weeks in a row without 1. So someone's taking financial risk because the bills you pay don't wait until you find blocks. Like electricity, or you're paying off a loan for the equipment you bought, they expect their payment on the day that they told you you have to pay, or else they take all your equipment. So you have to deal with the real world. So someone has to take the financial risk. What's transformed in this space is that the pools have been taking that risk. First of all, they pool a bunch of miners together. So it goes from like once a year I should get paid, or a block is found, to like once a day or more frequently, because I'm working with other miners and then I get my share. Then on top of that, some pools, and what has become the dominant payout mechanism, is the pool guarantees the miner, we're going to pay you every day, no matter what. Even if we don't find the number of blocks we expected to, we're going to pay you no matter what. Well, if you make that contract with them, that means you need to have a lot of liquidity. Because if you hit a bad luck factor, you need to keep paying out every day to the miners. Well, that requires a lot of money. And we've seen pools fail because they didn't have enough liquidity and they went into a really bad luck factor. In fact, I think recently Foundry went through bad luck last year and they had to lay off a lot of employees. So, and other pools have literally gone bankrupt and failed. So small pools. So the question, why are these other pools using Bitmain? Like what, why are they still have the brand, their brand name, but actually under the hood, it's Bitmain. It's like that centralizing force of Bitmain's like, don't worry, we've got the liquidity.
Effectively an insurance company.
Yeah, exactly. So miners don't want the risk, so they've given it to like Brains and Binance Pool, and then those pools don't want the risk, so they've given it to Bitmain. So it's all centralized around Bitmain. And Bitmain and Foundry now are, you know, 85%+ of the network.
And Bitmain probably has given it to the Chinese government somehow, right? So it all comes back to China still controls Dash.
And I know we're over time, so we should wrap, but I think there's at least some optimism in some of the stuff we were talking about in person this week. I think Stratum V2 is one of the things that might help correct this. And then you also mentioned the Braid Pool is a share mechanism I was not very familiar with. So I'd like to hear more about that.
So Stratum V2 is an improvement and definitely improves things, but it's not like a silver bullet. A Braid Pool promises to be the silver bullet. It could be the silver bullet. It's much more at the R&D stage. So there's still a lot of like uncertainty of, you know, can this be built and can it actually be deployed and be effective? But at least it does strike at the heart of this problem. The heart of the problem is that like Bitcoin mines blocks on average every 10 minutes. And so it plays into this, like, yeah. So let's say I have a mining farm that I can mine a block. I'm expected to mine a block once a year. What Braid Pool does is accelerate that by like 6,000x. Uh-huh. So it would just be whatever the math is on that, like 20? So like once an hour. So I have a small enough farm that I'm only expecting to mine a block once a year. I use Braid Pool and now I get a payout every hour. Obviously, it doesn't mean I get 6,000 times more money. It's just whatever that expected payout is over a year, divide that by 6,000 and I get paid out every hour. That's what Braid Pool promises to do. So if it's able to work, then that fundamentally solves the problem. And we literally don't need pools anymore and we don't have to have the centralization.
And this is early R&D. Like if the R&D pays off, do we have a sense of over what time period we might see this start to happen? Is this years away or might we see progress or evidence
faster than a year? So like it's
2 weeks, okay. David.
Anything good in Bitcoin is many years away. So year or two of getting to an alpha beta stage and then like probably a couple of years of like fixing and then like many years of deployment, so maybe like 8 years. But I mean, the reality is, it's not like Bitcoin's going to die in the next 8 years because of that problem. It would be amazing if the timeline I just gave and if the solution works the way I described it, and it happens in 8 years. That's amazing.
Guys, I know we're over time, and I think we are probably due for another deep mining episode in general because there's so much to talk about. But one last very quick question, because I have not seen any good analysis of this online yet. And I'm curious if you guys have a hunch. If you've been checking on Mempool, two things happened last week. One, the Mempool cleared, I think it was last weekend or something. And then two, the Bitcoin hash rate, which is currently around 750-ish exahash, briefly touched 980 exahash, almost 1,000 exahash. I'm assuming those two things are related and that the hash rate helped crunch the mempool. Do you have any idea what happened there? Why it spiked so high and went off?
Well, let's see. I mean, I think that there's a little bit of relation there, but they're mostly unrelated. I think the mempool cleared largely just because there's not a whole lot of demand for transactions, right? And what's been the demand for transactions the past couple of years? It's ordinals, BRC20, runes, NFTs, and Bitcoin. We know that for a fact. Yeah, I mean, we know that for a fact. It's public data. We can look at it. We can analyze it. We know how much of the blocks have been filled up the past 2 years of that, and it's substantial. So, I mean, one thing that is quite evident is like that's just not happening right now. So, not super surprising that was a fad and it's kind of gone away. It could come back. But like it's definitely gone away in the interim, and so that's the dominant factor. So yes, if it within an epoch, meaning a 2 week period roughly, when the mining difficulty adjustment does not change within that window of time, yes, you're correct that if hash rate increases, we mine blocks faster. It's not every 10 minutes; it's maybe every 9 minutes and 40 seconds or whatever, and that does help the mempool clear. But I think that's like a minor factor.
Do you have any idea why the hash rate spiked so high?
I mean, nothing specific, but it didn't surprise me. I mean, like it's mostly not real time. Like it's mostly like operation like comes up with a plan to invest $500 million in a mining operation, and it takes like 12 to 24 months for that all to play out. So almost independent of the real time dynamics of Bitcoin, like the mempool and the price of Bitcoin and all this stuff doesn't really matter. When you reach that point to when you turn the switch on, most of your costs are sunk. So the only economic cost you're looking at is like, okay, if I turn it on, what are my variable costs and am I going to make more money than that? And usually the answer is yes. So they turn it on.
So I just think it's kind of unusual that we basically grew 30%+ very briefly and fell off. And I mean, this was an all-time high, like almost 1,000 exahash. It
didn't sound so much. Hash rate grew 30%.
Yeah, if you look. I mean, I'm looking right now.
I think what you're looking at is like, it's a measuring hash rate. You can never measure a hash rate perfectly. Sure. You're just sort of sampling. So if you look at too small a window of time, you could see what appears to be 30% swings, but that's not, you really have to zoom out. And I think it's like, I think it's what, like 750 or 800 exahash per second
today, but it's, I mean, it touched almost 1,000, and the 1 week moving average is 850. So clearly there was some new folks plugging in, and it could be that the economics changed on the ground, or it could be something I've been thinking about. Is this like new potentially state actors that are testing?
Yeah.
What's a podcast without a good conspiracy theory?
Yeah. Well, what's a podcast without ending on that? Okay.
Could be.
All right. Well, if that's true, we will talk about it next week or whenever we hear about it. All right. We wrap?
Thanks.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
Bye.
Good fun.